So as we recover from the almost daily surprises from the US President Donald Trump, my first guest this hour will advise us on how to perhaps prepare for the next upheaval likely to have global implications. President Donald Trump has vowed to cancel the participation of the US in the Paris Climate Change Agreement, to cancel the Clean Power Plan, which was all about reducing carbon emissions from power stations, and, as we speak, all references to climate change are being scrubbed from US government material and policy. Instead, he's vowed to boost the US oil, gas, and coal mining industries. Now, this has further galvanised the world-renowned climate scientist Professor Michael Mann, who's just about to board a flight to Australia to talk about the implications of this US shift in dealing with climate change and what to do about it. His most recent book is called The Madhouse Effect: How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics and Driving Us Crazy. And Michael Mann, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Paint us a picture, if you would, please, of what is happening behind the scenes in terms of the Trump administration's early approach to climate change.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I can give you a behind-the-scenes look at what they're doing. I can tell you from, you know, looking from the outside in, it doesn't look good. And I thought you summarized it very well. Every signal that they have sent thus far indicates that they plan to undo the progress that has been made over the last 8 years in getting the U.S. involved in international efforts to lower carbon emissions, to keep climate change below dangerous escalating levels. They've appointed two key posts within the government, prominent climate change deniers, many of whom are closely associated with polluting interests like the Koch brothers or ExxonMobil, indeed the Secretary of State. Rex Tillerson is the CEO of ExxonMobil, and some have argued that essentially we are now a petrostate with this change in direction in the incoming Trump administration. So, yeah, it's caused quite a bit of concern among scientists and pretty much anybody who recognizes that if we are going to keep climate change, keep warming below dangerous levels, we have to act now internationally, and the U.S. has to be part of that leadership.
It is interesting when you sum up all the various evidence. It is interesting, for instance, Trump's appointed Myron Ebell, I think it is, to lead his EPA Environmental Protection Agency transition team, and he really doesn't like science. I understand. I mean, I'm not sure. I haven't read his accounts in detail, but he wants to gut the agency, and that team also included David Schneer and Chris Horner, who've been quite strong strongly involved in. Well, not exactly being friendly to climate scientists. Here's what the transition team had to say about how the EPA currently uses science. EPA does not use science to guide regulatory policy as much as it uses regulatory policy to steer the science. EPA has greatly increased its science manipulation. Gee whiz, that's not easy to bridge.
Well, you know, now in the lexicon, at least in the U.S., and I think this is true in Australia as well, you know, we have these new terms, fake news, and now alternative facts out of the mouth of the spokesperson for the Trump administration. Those of us who have been dealing with climate change denial, who have been on the front lines of this battle for years, have been dealing with these things for years. It's not new to us. The idea that those who find the overwhelming implications of the science inconvenient because of, you know, their interests, because, you know, of the profits from the continued sale of fossil fuels, they simply reject what the overwhelming community of scientists in the world have said, that climate change is real, it's caused by the burning of fossil fuels and escalating greenhouse gas emissions, and negative effects are already being seen and will get much worse if we don't act. And so to those who find that inconvenient because it implies we have to get off our reliance on fossil fuels, they have found it convenient to simply attack the science and to replace actual scientific facts with fake facts.
Could I just put it to you, what I read the other day from somebody, an analyst who's not a climate scientist, said that, in fact, a lot of people are not denying climate science. They deny the apocalyptic nature of the prophecies, and they actually have come to be less trusting of the scientists' nuanced analysis. Now, is this something that you would take on to at least consider?
Well, so this is what we call in the Madhouse effect the kinder, gentler form of denialism, which is a form of denial that attempts to establish credibility by saying, oh, we concede the science. We don't deny the science. When in fact, when you look at the specifics, many of these folks are ignoring what the projections have to say. They're downplaying the implications of climate change. They are magnifying the costs of taking action and dismissing the much greater costs of not acting to avert a catastrophe. So in reality, they are denying facts, they are denying science, but they find it convenient to try to claim that they are accepting the science to buy a certain amount of credibility. And I'll tell you why, because it's no longer credible to the American people, and I think this is true in Australia as well, to simply deny that climate change is happening, because the impacts have become so profound, we can see them with our own two eyes. And people understand that something's happening. And so when a politician or a lobbyist or a fossil fuel industry spokesperson says that it's not happening, that just isn't credible. So what they've found convenient is to sort of step up to that next level of denial, which is, okay, well, we claim we're not denying the science. They claim they're not denying the science, but they are. They're denying what the science has to say about the costs of inaction, about the impacts, and the extent to which we are seeing bad things happen already.
Look, because I'll quote something else that's interesting. For instance, that the new people coming in have ordered that the EPA takes down its climate webpage, and they've mandated that any studies or data from EPA scientists must undergo review by political appointees before it can be released to the public. Now, I can see that might really rile people working within the EPA, but there could be a lot of other people, because that happens in lots of departments, if you know what I mean, who might say, well, okay, they've got to persuade, they've got to argue their case and persuade the people who are releasing it to the public that they've got something to say. Is that such a bad thing?
Oh, it's terrifying, because when you actually, you know, listen closely to what they're saying, is they want to replace peer review, the test that has always been used in the world of science, where independent experts who understand the science assess a claim or a finding, and that's, you know, the peer review process is what Carl Sagan, the great science communicator Carl Sagan, used to describe as part of the self-correcting machinery of science. What keeps science true and moving in the direction of truth. And what they want to do is replace the actual mechanisms that science has to evaluate the credibility of a claim with politics, with political oversight. And to students of history who are familiar with the disaster of Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union in the early 20th century, that this really harkens back to the age of Lysenkoism. It is exactly the sort of thing that George Orwell feared, the idea that that politics would be used to evaluate which facts are accepted and which facts aren't. It gets back to this world of alternative facts where, you know, the Trump administration, when it comes to issues like climate change, wants to deny the overwhelming scientific evidence from the world's scientists and replace it with their own set of very convenient, from their standpoint, from the fossil fuel industry standpoint, very convenient alternative facts.
Yeah, let me just tell listeners that Michael Mann is my guest. He's the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Pennsylvania State University. Through his pioneering research into the Earth's climate system, he's received many honours and awards. He's the author of several books on climate change, and he'll be in Australia for two lectures, which I'll mention a little bit later. So I also noticed a piece in The Guardian this week about how the Bush administration, George W. Bush's administration, attempted to censor climate science reports. And government scientists were warned not to use the term global warming, for instance. And many scientists apparently self-censored. It seems different now. There are whistleblowers and leaks everywhere. Is that how you read it?
Yeah, I think living through that episode sort of awoke scientists to the fact that they can't ignore the politics, whether or not they like politics or want to in any way be involved in them. Politics came to them. If you were a scientist working in an area of science where your findings were a threat to powerful vested interests, then they were going to come after you, or they were going to, in this case, the Bush administration was trying to prevent government scientists working in areas like climate change from even speaking to the media. Now, I'll tell you that George W. Bush himself was actually quite good on the campaign trail originally and at the beginning of his administration. He had a fairly forward-looking view about climate change, as did his father, George H.W. Bush, who was, by some measures, an environmental hero in terms of the things that they passed, the environmental policies that they passed. And what happened was that Dick Cheney came in and sort of overtook their energy and climate policy and brought in his henchmen, Enron and other fossil fuel interests, and that's where things went awry, and that's where you started to see the censoring of government scientists. Now, the same thing happened in Canada under their previous administration when they had a conservative prime minister. They, too, were censoring government scientists, preventing them from talking to the media. It was actually the same fossil fuel lobbyists who were advising their administration on how to basically censor science that might be seem inconvenient to powerful interests. And now, of course, the shoe is back on the other foot. Under Trudeau, Canada is now embracing science. They're no longer censoring government scientists. But we've got the problem now back in the U.S., where under the Trump administration, we're entering a new era here of government scientists not being allowed to talk to media, information being taken down from websites if it's inconvenient to the fossil fuel interests that are running this.
Well, there's a big pushback. It's just, pardon me interrupting, there's a global march for science planned, I gather, just observing the success of that women's demonstration plan for April the 22nd.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, this is unusual. Scientists prefer, we prefer to spend our time, in general, in the lab, out in the field, teaching, doing research. Scientists don't really like to be politically active. It's not why you go into science. But what's happened is the politics has come to us. Whether we like it or not, science is being politicized by those who have an axe to grind, who want to suppress scientific findings they don't like. And scientists are fighting back. We've seen it before. We learned our lesson in the Bush administration under, the leadership of Dick Cheney and his energy policies. And I think having learned that, we're now seeing scientists far more enlightened about the threat and far more willing to take action, even, as you say, marching in the streets to raise awareness.
Amazing. You'll be landing in Australia, as we've been discussing a very interesting plan that's emerged just this week, focusing on energy security and affordability. In fact, the Turnbull government is saying we are wrapping ourselves in the cloak of reasonable cost, cheap, in fact, electricity, and that's how they're distinguishing themselves, or it would appear that's what they're going to do. And they're looking at ways of encouraging new clean coal, quotes, power stations and lifting moratoriums on coal seam gas extraction. So this is a very interesting development. It followed a terrible outage in one of our states, South Australia, where literally everything went down. It's a complex story. But it was a big shock for all concerned. It went for about 7 hours and the whole state was out of electricity. So you're coming at an interesting time.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, sometimes tragedies and unfortunate circumstances like that are exploited by politicians who've been looking for.
But it's a genuine yeah. response too. I mean, it was a terrible event, if you know what I mean.
Oh yeah, no question about it. But the real solution is what I'm saying is not more fossil fuel energy. It's not coal. It's to create a smart grid that takes advantage of the immense amount of renewable energy that Australia has access to. Solar, you know, when it comes to solar energy, Australia may be the perfect country in terms of the potential for solar energy, and solar and wind and other renewables are now basically achieving competitiveness in the market with fossil fuels.
Sort of,
and
although that's
even
what's
accounting for the damage.
That's what's emerging is a very interesting debate. You know, that there's this trifecta of focus on security, affordability, and low emissions. That's what our Prime Minister says, and the Minister, and they're sort of they're encouraging people to think, I'd say, beyond what the mere science says, if I can put it like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the end, we need to find a way to provide, you know, the growing demand on, you know, the demand on energy, which is projected to grow in the future, in a way that doesn't fundamentally degrade our planet. And the good news is the technology already exists in terms of renewable energy. We just need to incentivize that technology, and we need to put a price on carbon so we level the energy market, the playing field, so that renewables can compete fairly against fossil fuels, the burning of which are literally destroying the planet.
Now, final question, if you can do this in a minute then. So what are you going to say in your lecture about a pathway forward in adapting so that people aren't filled with despair?
Yeah, so, you know, people will be surprised that despite the title of our book, The Madhouse Effect, and despite the developments that we've been talking about, I remain somewhat optimistic. And the reason I remain optimistic is that we're just seeing immense growth in renewable energy. The world has collectively made the decision that it's going to move forward, that the 21st energy century energy economy, the revolution of this century, is going to be renewable energy. And that's the direction things are moving. We just need to make sure they move fast enough that we don't commit to ever more dangerous changes in climate.
Look, thank you very much indeed. And I do hope that you enjoy your visit here.
I'm very much looking forward to it. Thank you.
And Michael Mann is the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State. He'll be giving two lectures this week, the first at Sydney University called Climate Change and Climate Politics, Where To Now? And the second is a Sydney Ideas event called The Madhouse Effect, Climate Change Denial in the Age of Trump. So if you care to seek that out, I think we'll have that on our website as well. You particularly asked us in your feedback, or some of you did, for more on climate change. So look, we're trying to deliver, just to prove to you that we do listen.